everybody. Patrick Connor here with my buddy Aris Pina, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. Man, we're again back trying to make this a regular thing, I swear. But we had some boxing this past weekend. While we plan on doing some history stuff later on this week, for now, we're going to keep this a recap show because it was a really fun fight card. Actually, there was a couple fight cards on this past weekend, man. How'd you like that show, that Showtime show?
I mean, so far, that might have been the best show of the year up to now and might stay up that way. That was top to bottom, three very good fights. The main event definitely delivered, and I had no complaints. It was a solid night of action.
You know, I guess just starting right out, I'll name drop our pal Corey Erdman, who writes for Boxing Scene. And, you know, he does a whole bunch of broadcasting stuff and commentating. If you're a fan of boxing and you do any sort of reading or anything like that about boxing, you've probably read something by Corey Erdman at this point. But regardless, he had written something for Boxing Scene, which I think was published yesterday, and he had said, and he had remarked also on Twitter, that this card, the Showtime card, the one that was headlined by Brandon Figueroa and Luis Nitti, that it was kind of like a throwback to matchmaking from a different time period. And I guess it's only fair to note that I'm partially name dropping this because he name dropped me in the article, and he's very kind to do so. But also, I guess just to hammer home the point that I was making in there was that the way that TV dates and stuff like that and streaming services and whatnot, the way that boxing cards are streamed now, and it's kind of like they're precious commodities, even though there's more now than there have been in years. It means that, like, almost everything that we see on TV is like some sort of title fight, whether it's a major title, a minor title, regional title, or some sort of contender type of fight. And we often don't really get fights that are made just because they're probably going to be good fights. And that was one of the things Corey was saying in his article. And I agree. And I think that a lot of attention was probably paid in to the matchmaking of the Showtime card, and it wound up being good. So, I mean, you have to give credit where it's due to Premier Boxing Champions there, because it was entertaining. And on top of that, it was like fighters who, these were not the top fighters in their division per se, but they were definitely among the top 5 to 10 in their divisions, and there were meaningful fights. But, yeah, you know, it was good stuff.
And they're just well made from top to bottom. You know, a card that reminded me of was the Jesus Soto Carras Berto card from when was that, over a decade ago or so now, or close to it?
That was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah. Damn. But, like, that was a card, same thing, like, top to bottom. Those were all just, like, really, really solid top fights that then all delivered. And a lot of people looked upon that card as, you know, one of the best ones that Showtime did around that time for that year.
Well, and it's funny you say that, too, because one of the fights that was in the – that was a Showtime fight, too. But one of the fights that was on the undercard of that was Omar Figueroa Jr., Brandon Figueroa's big brother. And that was against Nihito Arakawa, where just beat the ever-loving crap out of him. I mean, it was kind of ugly, but it was entertaining. It was like a really entertaining one-sided beatdown. Unfortunately, No, that was definitely a fun fight card. That was cool. And
like one of those, another one like Margarito against Antonio Diaz from I think the early 2000s. Like it was one of those type of shows where you, like you said, you're having two guys evenly matched, where you're not really sure who's gonna win, and you know it's just gonna be exciting nonetheless, and there are implications involved, or you know, like crossroads fight there, it's something going on. Like there's a lot of stuff. And it always just ends up being awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I mean, I think that one of the things that wound up making it a lot of fun, and I don't know, I mean, perhaps the entire thing didn't hinge on just this main event result, but a lot of it was that it was surprising, in my opinion. You know, you started out the broadcast with two very good fights, but then the third fight was also pretty damn good. Not only was it pretty damn good, but it had an unexpected result because I think the prevailing opinion before the fight, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong or if you disagreed or whatever, but it seemed as though Brandon Figueroa was viewed as kind of soft, not ready for somebody of Luis Neri's caliber, not ready for somebody of his strength, maybe a little bit too experienced for Brandon Figueroa. And that definitely wound up obviously not being the case. And to the point where, I mean, Figueroa, like in the last two or three rounds, just beat the shit out of him. It got a little bit, I was kind of like, damn, dude, like he's starting to put the whooping on him. And early on, one of the things he was running them through the gauntlet. And in the maybe like the second or third round, I think I tweeted something like, if Neri keeps swinging like this, you know, he's going to tire himself out.
Well, yeah, that's
exactly what happened. I mean, that's his style, but still, he was just swinging like he was like he needed to get out of there. Like he had somewhere to be, and he was whiff. Was, oh, man. So he tired out, and it was a lot of fun, though. And I think that unexpected result was at least in part why the show, like to end to kind of on that crescendo, was like, damn, all right then.
Absolutely. And I think that was like a satisfying win that a lot of people were just happy to see the results of too, for, a lot of the stuff that Neri's done in the past, you know, coming in with his weight issues, being popped for various things, you know, the way he basically ravaged Shinsuke Yamanaka, who deserved a lot better ending than what he got against Neri, and got him banned in Japan at that. And, you know, coming through up and how he always just had that undisciplined, very like air of arrogance about him that he thought he can just kind of do what he want. And, you know, he was able to bully his opponents because of that and beat guys down, because he's a very strong individual. Like you said, he has a swarming style, and usually because he's so much bigger than his opponents when he was especially at bantamweight back then, he was able to do that. But when he moved up to one for the junior featherweight fight right now, and it obviously wasn't going to happen at this point. In the first two rounds, I thought Figueroa was fighting a ridiculous fight, and not in a good way. You know, he was coming right in. He wasn't using his height. He wasn't trying to keep his distance. He was banging right away with Neri. And he was taking a lot of shots at that point, too. But he was also landing back. But I was thinking to myself, you know, I wonder how long Geek was going to be able to hold up on this, because Neri was chugging along. But like you mentioned, around the third or fourth round, when I thought that Figueroa was like had his, you know, settled down and had his ground under him, he started slugging back at Neri and landing a lot more effectively too. And I thought to myself, you know what, Neri's not going to be able to bully this guy or take him out, which he wasn't going to be able to. It was only going to be a matter of time from there, especially if he kept up that same style, which I think you texted me at one point, you know, Neri is throwing punches like an idiot. It just, you know, kept on going. And he did. He had the same style, like a whirlwind, and he wasn't really trying to, like, hold up the gas. And Figueroa was landing a tremendous amount of body shots and, like, some great shots to the head, too. You know, uppercuts, hooks, right hands, you name it. And Neri was taking them. But Neri also wasn't backing up, but he was wilting from that. This was different. He wasn't able to like bully a guy around like he was able to do with Yamanaka or a Payano or this one or that one. He wasn't able to pull that this time. You know, now he fought a guy who was a lot bigger than him, stronger than him now, in fact, and was able to bully him back, and there he didn't have any answers for that. And because he shot his load at that point, you know, because he never stopped throwing punches from round one up until the ending. He just kept on winging. He was completely gassed out. And then the ending, well, you know, you saw it. Figueroa landed the body shot that just caved Neri in.
Yeah, I think that you described it pretty well. And you're also telling the truth. We were messaging or texting back and forth during the fight, and I was like, man, this guy's throwing like a fucking idiot. I think those were the words I used.
I mean, that's the apt description of it. He was just throwing and throwing to the point where he almost expected, because like just waiting for Figueroa to fall like everyone else did, because that's what he expected him to do. It's a style, and I mean, it's a strong style. He comes out there, he just throws a flurry of punches, and usually he's able to overwhelm his opponents that way. But since he wasn't able to do that, you saw after that one point, he tried backing up and boxing a little bit because he realized that, you know, this whole Henry Armstrong, Mike Tyson approach wasn't going to work. And even then, at that point, it wasn't working either, because Figueroa just walked him down and kept on banging away at him. And so he tried to go back to slugging again, and then that's what, you know, did him in.
And it was as if, he thought, perhaps it was that he had an issue with the weight, and he thought he needed to unload early because he wasn't going to last. I mean, that's a possibility too. But he fought as if he thought the way that he fought was going to be too much for Figueroa. That Figueroa was not going to be able to handle that. Like, he was going to be physically taken aback, that he was going to be pushed around fairly easily. And on, I think that something that Figueroa did in like the first round or two, he fought kind of small, and I was like, oh shit, he's kind of buying into it. You know, he's falling into it a little too
exactly,
much.
That's what I thought.
And I was like, oh no, I don't know that he's going to last like this, you know. And but even so, even though he was fighting kind of a dumb fight, it was that Neddy was just like, ah, well, whatever. I guess I'm just going to whoop his ass, so I'm just going to throw. And that obviously wound up being the wrong call. And then as soon as Figueroa broke through with body shots, and I will say, often you don't see the taller fighter going to the body for a handful of reasons, the primary one being that it opens you up. And if you're trying to keep your distance, or if you're trying to use height, use your reach, and you know, you have to fall in a little bit, or at least lean in to get to the body, and that gives you up defensively. And so you often don't see the taller guy going to the body. I mean, Lennox Lewis was like, you know, he used to jab to the body sometimes, but otherwise was not much of a body puncher. And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Vladimir Klitschko, also notorious for, like, not really throwing body punches. And to see Figueroa dig in there and start going to the body was like, uh-oh. You know, the combination of Neddy's throwing caution to the wind and just taking it to the body got to him. And Figueroa, I got to say,
the guy that was a lot bigger than him and just was able to beat him down that way.
And he kind of like rose to the occasion too. You know, I think it was kind of a combination of Neddy fighting a dumb fight, but Figueroa kind of like outdoing expectations and rising to
really
the occasion,
did.
Like I said.
Absolutely. Because what? Figueroa's biggest wins before that were what? Moses Flores? You know, Escandon? Oscar, I can't say that last name.
Escandon, yeah. There were a handful of guys,
you know,
that
like,
were kind of in that middle level.
They weren't on the level of Neri, you know what I mean, at that point. So, and he's still being a young guy, the style that he type of had, like you said, where he doesn't really fight to his advantage that way, and he takes a lot of punches. It, people, you know, most people, and respectively right, they thought that Neri was going to be able to beat him down and grind him down either to a decision or a late-round stoppage. But Figueroa did rise to the occasion. He'd actually, you know, stepped it up to another level that people weren't sure if he was able to do. But, you know, he passed all tests that way, and all roads ahead now to Fulton.
And that's actually, when I was looking at BoxRec earlier, they already have a tentative date set for the Fulton fight.
Well, they
and
did,
I mean,
yeah, Showtime unleashed that schedule back in the day, I think. They said that, that they were already going to do that.
Yeah, and it looks like a pretty pretty robust schedule, I must say. And I don't know if all of the dates are going to stick, but it sure looks like they're going to be going forward with it. And Figueroa didn't look like he took a whole lot of damage or got his ass kicked much.
He took a lot of punches, but again, it's a guy that wasn't as big as him, so it didn't really affect him as much as, you know, he'll be good to go, especially by then.
Yeah. It's so it just got a whole lot more interesting. And, you know, you have a guy who's what, he's like 22 or 23 or 24, something like that. Either way, he's in his early 20s. He's probably going to keep growing. Wouldn't be surprised if he wound up making his way to lightweight, maybe even a little bit higher. He's like 5'8 or 5'9, something like that. And I don't know whatever it is got into their family tree, but it's like a family of good looking people. He's a doll. I don't know what's going on.
He fits in right with all the other pretty boys from the past, from Ryan Garcia all the way to Aragon and, you know, others from past.
Yeah, the original golden boy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just... I mean, not as arrogant, don't get me wrong. They were all pretty boys that, you know, everyone wanted to see get their ass kicked at one point or another. But because everybody likes to see the pretty boy get beat up one point, don't they?
I think it's kind of nice to every so often make sure that they understand that, you know, that ain't going to fly.
Yeah,
every
absolutely.
So often it's got to happen. You know, every so often they got to get their ass kicked. But it's so far that hasn't come for Brandon Figueroa. It's got places to go.
Yeah, for sure. There's always at least one point, though, there's like a Mike Tyson or a Jake LaMotta or some Benny Briscoe, really gnarly, mean guy that's just looking to maul a face up.
Yeah, dude, this is not a sport for attractive people like that. You know, it's just not. You know, it's funny too, because not that long ago, I don't know why this totally just reminds me of that, but like a week ago on the Boxing History account, Rich LeMontagne, I don't know if you remember him.
Cruiserweight. I remember him, the cruiserweight. Yeah, of course. Because he scored that ridiculous knockout of Michael Bennett, I think.
Yep.
Michael Bennett.
He scored a handful of them on like Friday Night Fights.
And then he would do that goofy shotgun celebration thing. Of course,
It was weird because it was like half bow and arrow, half shotgun.
it was the most ridiculous thing you'd ever seen. It was absurd.
He seemed like cool enough, but he hit me up on Twitter, or at least somebody who was going by his scream name, because he was like, hey, you know, is that the same blah, blah, blah that I fought in the, you know, something, something. And I was like, hold on, let me see if I can find some newspaper account of this, because I was curious. And I think it was in response to the Booker T. Word knockout of Anthony Hembrick. Yeah, because he was... And he responded, he said, hey, is that the Anthony Hembrick I fought in the Golden Gloves or something? And I was like, all right, well, let me go look. And so one of the first articles that popped up about Rich LeMontagne was that he had apparently signed on, like, in the late 90s, I think it was, to be a model for, like, Elle McPherson. Do you remember her? Supermodel?
Yeah.
From the 90s. She had, like, a clothing and underwear line, and he was, like, a spokesmodel and spokesperson. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, like, he literally had, like, model looks. And then after, like, a handful of fights, like, he started getting scarring over his eyes and still, like, I'm sure just a perfectly good-looking human being and way better than looking than me, like, you know, the caveman person. But nonetheless, point being, this is not a sport that's, like, kind to people, and you go through it for, like, a few years and that shit will fuck your face up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So there's your little Rich LeMontagne side story for the day. I guess we have a little history. We couldn't keep it out, right?
Just to say it right there, if you've never seen his knockout of Michael Bennett, and pretty sure it's on YouTube, I haven't checked, but or something else, you should check it out, because that thing was fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was one of the highlight real knockouts that Friday Night Fights ever had on their show, probably.
Yeah, and there's right there in the early 2000s, there was a couple of really good ones. But yeah, it's, you know, Figueroa, young dude, seems like, it kind of seems funny, because had he lost this, had he been not physically well-matched for Luis Neri, had he been steamrolled or something like that, I think a lot of people would have been saying, see, we told you. He wasn't going to go anywhere. He wasn't strong enough. But then now he wins the fight, and people are like, see, he's going places. He's got a lot of time, you know, could go up a few weight classes. So it's very fickle. You know, you got to be careful. But for the time being, it seems as though he's obviously on the right track, and it was a pretty good win.
It was a very good win. But how do you see now him moving ahead to fight Stephen Fulton? Would you consider him an underdog in that fight still? Even after this win, or, you know, closer to a fate, like, how, because even after this, and I thought that was still an impressive win, I still think Fulton has the tools to probably, you know, beat him when they fight.
Yeah,
all
I think
that, considered.
I think that Fulton he's probably not going to go balls to the wall like Neri did and, like, you know, lose his shit and get tired fairly early in the fight. Like Neri did. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's already right there a pretty good advantage in the fight. I mean, it's tough to say, because Fulton himself, it's like every fighter, this is always like the paradox or the conundrum in boxing. And that's that when you kind of bring up new matchups or talk about a new fighter or a young fighter, or often somebody who hasn't quite been tested, it's like, well, they haven't fought anybody. And of course, you have to say, and I don't want to like, you don't want to be reductive in the argument to the point where like, you know, you make it like to where the conversation's not even worth having. But you do have to say, well, every fighter, every single fighter at some point had been at a point in their career where they hadn't yet fought anybody. And so every fighter needs that opportunity to prove themselves or to, they need that opportunity to fight someone. And to me, this is kind of like, well, that was Figueroa's opportunity to fight somebody, Luis Neri, and he passed. He got the opportunity. He took the, he got the, made the most of it. He did well. He won, and he won emphatically. He won in a way that got people talking and on a card that was a lot of fun, and also following two fights that were tough acts to follow. So, you know, he made the most of that opportunity, and that's kind of like how I would see the Fulton in this matchup, where even though Figueroa is not that much more experienced, even just that win and perhaps the Ceja draw, a couple of those other fights would give him more experience on the world stage or on the kind of like, you know, world-class level than Fulton. So this is Fulton's opportunity to step up and see what he's about. And personally, I think that he's definitely more skilled than Luis Neri. And he's probably not going to approach the fight in the same way. And he might force Figueroa to figure things out a little bit more. He might force him to think a little bit more in the fight. And so I'd at least like to see how it played out.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a fascinating matchup. Both guys are undefeated. Hopefully, it will still be a unification of the titles. Who knows what these, you know, organizations like to pull before fights.
And that's another thing that you were, when you were mentioning before, you know, you brought up a good point about the win for Figueroa being like something of like karma or justice, you know, for Luis Neri because of the shenanigans. And that's also demonstrating not just him too, because I mean, it's it falls under the umbrella of just because you can doesn't mean you should. But at the same time, the WBC was totally enabling this shit, like every step of the way, making up excuses and going, well, it's not that big a deal, or writing this off and still allowing him to have this title or whatever, this opportunity. And it's like, yeah, who fucking knows what any of these sanctioning organizations are going to do whatsoever at this point. But that would be kind of cool for it to be, even though it's funny because we sometimes say, well, don't pay attention to the belts. I don't really know sometimes how else to track some of this stuff and how to track who's beaten who or who's able to fight who for that matter. But it would be kind of cool at least for there to be no question as to who's the best or who has all the belts or whatever the case may be, you know?
For sure, for sure. And not only from there, bro, you know, there's still other key guys in the division. Like Danny Roman had a, you know, really solid win on the undercard. He's still a player in the division. You know, the guy that beat Roman for the belt, Akhmadaliev.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Like, there's a lot of good talent going around over there, man. It's just like, and then eventually too, I can't imagine that the guy that's going to be fighting Donaire pretty soon, Oblali.
Yeah.
He's a big guy. You see the size of him and the size of his, you know, the strength of his back and everything like that. Like he's a pretty solid looking guy that I imagine him moving up eventually one day. So, you know, super bantamweight is looking pretty good right now.
Yeah, there is no question that, like I was just saying the other day, from about featherweight on down for
I'm sorry, I didn't even meant to mention this too. Of course, you got the monster who so it can fluctuate right anywhere.
and from featherweight on down for several years has just been, you know, it's been kicking off. It really has. And now there's kind of like less of an excuse where, I mean, you and I have talked about this endlessly, where in years past we would have been reading about this or that in the ring and then maybe seeing it a year later or delayed or whatever the case may be. Or a lot of these fights we can see live, or if we don't see them live, we can see them within a few days or something like that. And it's really cool to be able to pay attention to a lot of these lower weight classes this way, because man, they've been just jam packed and 122
and
pounds.
They always produce great fights and solid fighters, and they've never been afraid to fight each other either, as opposed to other divisions where there's always politics and this thing and that thing getting in the way and all that. Yeah. And it takes almost years for a fight to develop. The guys at the lower weights, from super bantamweight, you know, featherweight, so on, flyweight, like, it's not difficult to really, you know, to make the two guys in that division convince them to fight each other. Not only are they willing to do it too, it doesn't cost a ton of money as it does for heavier divisions to make fights like that.
Yeah, exactly. You can often secure a lot of these lower weight fights for a much smaller fee than it's going to take for. Well, I mean, so just for an example, and it seems like right now they're going off on social media about Tyson Fury versus Anthony Joshua, because yesterday, and we're recording this Monday, but yesterday on Sunday, it was like semi-announced by Anthony Joshua that they were going to be fighting, I think it was August 15th, and that they were both going to be guaranteed $75 million. And it sounded like, and given what happened today, it sounded like they were trying their hardest to try to get some sort of promotional momentum behind that before today, which wound up being that a court ruled Deontay Wilder had the right to a rematch with Tyson, to a rubber match with Tyson Fury before he takes on Anthony Joshua. So, and that literally just happened in like the last 15 to 20 minutes or something. So, I mean, you know, it's just like ridiculous. Number one, $75 million each to secure that fight is like, okay. Second, the winding, stupid ass road that any of these fights have had to go down just to get made are just incredible, which brings us back to these lower weights where, like, generally speaking, there aren't going to be roadblocks like that. There aren't going to be those kinds of, you know, fucking just crazy barriers to make those fights. So it's such a crime that they get ignored the way that they do. And just to kind of circle back to around what you were saying, on that undercard, Danny Roman, you know, he's got plenty of experience in the weight class and plenty of experience in that kind of like right around that level. And he had that loss to Akhmadaliev, who is like the other, you know, unified champion in that division. So, you know, there's a lot of possibilities right around there.
He deserves a rematch in that fight, or at least another high profile fight after that. You know, he's always been a solid individual. He's one of the best fighters in the division, obviously. He always produces well, and that was a really legitimately close fight that he had with Akhmadaliev.
I think that what probably hurts him is once he has gotten, you know, toward this level, he just doesn't really have a whole ton of power and is having to rely a little bit more on grit, a little bit more on effort. But still, yeah, he kept it really close against Akhmadaliev, who himself is a heck of a fighter, and I think tied Leon Spinks' record for winning not just like a single world title, but like a unified world title or whatever, mm-hmm. in the least amount of fights.
Yeah.
I mean, that in and of itself doesn't make him like, you know, savior or anything like that, but still, point being, you know, he's a very solid fighter. And so, yeah, he probably deserves that rematch, but it would be nice to see all of these trinkets collected all together. But that was a really good fight. Yeah, that was, there's just something about the Home Depot Center, Dignity Health Sports Park, whatever, StubHub Center, that's just magic, dude. Bring it.
It's, I mean, they put on, they've always, I've never actually been there to attend a fight. I hope to one day, but you know, the atmosphere there is really small, kind of intimate and stuff like that. There's not a bad seat in the house, and it always just kind of produces electric fights.
It's a tennis court. So like
Yeah.
it's the UC or USC, whatever, San Dominguez Hills in Carson. I mean, I've been there a whole bunch of times, and it's a tennis court. So it's like this little bowl, but it's like the perfect, it's like the perfect way to see boxing, because when you wind up seeing it in a bunch of different arenas and shit like that, there are so many spots where you can't see shit. Like where maybe if it's the ring posts or just the way that like the seats go, like they're too flat so that there's too many people in front of you or something. But it's really perfect because the way that everything's slanted, you could see everything great. And I don't know. I don't know what it is about that place, but I mean, I've seen Rios Alvarado one there. I saw Vasquez Marquez three there. I mean, even, what was it? It was Arislandi Lada versus, what's his name? Angulo. Yeah. I mean, like there've just been a shitload of fights there that just brought it out. And I don't know why that is, but something about the venue is pretty magic. Well, and
was Kelvin Brock against Abragamov at that place?
I'm not sure.
Not that you should even look it up, but I was just curious because I remember watching it on HBO like way back when Boxing After Dark turned really, really bad.
the boxing banker.
Yeah, in like the early 2000s, but I mean, it's always been a dope venue. Just...
No, it looks like that was at Caesar's Palace, actually. Wow, that was at Caesar's Palace in 2006? Wow.
The Abragamov?
Wow. Well, just to see it in 2006, something at Caesar's Palace is pretty, you know, that's like late 80s, early 90s shit. But no, that's what it says.
Interesting.
The boxing banker. Yeah. No, it's a really great venue, and Danny Roman, you know, turned in a really good win too. And that other fight on the opening fight on the card, Xavier Martinez versus Juan Carlos Burgos.
That was a hell of a fight too. Yeah.
Man, Burgos is another guy, you know, kind of like Roman, but maybe, you know, a little bit more on the experienced side. But I mean, just a lot of experience toward that level. And
he's been around a long time.
Yeah. He turned pro in like 2002, 3, something like that. He's been around a while, and he's the kind of guy who can very reliably go rounds. He's gone rounds against some pretty good punchers, fighters who, even if they weren't pretty good punchers, are known to, you know, overwhelm. Hasegawa, Mikey Garcia,
yeah,
Devin Haney. None of these guys could take him out. You know, they beat him, but that's kind of like his role. You know, he's going to give you rounds, and he's going to give you a very difficult fight, but there's a good chance that it's going to be in losing. You know, there's the world needs ditches or two, as they say, and that's kind of just the role that he has fulfilled, and that's what he's doing in the kind of junior lightweight division right now.
It's not a bad thing. He's still a serviceable gatekeeper at that point, and that's what all divisions really need, a person that's going to stay there and give you rounds, and he's not going to be easy to blow out, and Burgos is certainly that type of guy. You know, we always talk about that in the heavyweight division, that people are like, oh, you know, a solid gatekeeper in division, stuff like that. But Burgos is perfect for that, for where he's at. Because anyone that tries to, that goes down with him, usually around, you know, from at lightweight or whatever, they're going to know they're in a fight with him. Burgos still, like, even though he's past it and he's, every time he'll step up, there's, you know, a better chance he's going to lose than he is he's going to win. But he still is still going to give you rounds and still serviceable, especially for up and comers, and he's still good for television as well.
No question. And that actually, you know, that kind of circles it back around to what I was saying right at the start about what Corey Erdman was saying on Boxing Scene with his recent article about this fight card, that it's not just about making fights that are brawls or fights that are, you know, guaranteed action fights like that. But there are ways also to make really entertaining fights with the style matchups.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, you know, the available fights too, with, you know, we were talking about the issues with promoters and various factions and stuff like that. A lot of the time, the available fights, like, you might not have blockbuster fights in your stable, but you might be able to match some really interesting styles before, you know, or in place of that. So it would be good to see some more creative matchmaking or some more focus on that.
It's like what, you know, Teddy, the late, great Teddy Brenner, the arguably the greatest matchmaker who ever lived, and a lot of people always say that. He mentioned, you know, I'm not directly quoting him here, but he said that the key to matchmaking was always just, for him, was just finding, like, guys who, you know, produce good fights and just trying to make it that way. I mean, it's not really as simple as that. Obviously, there's a lot of other things involved, but if you want to make a good fight, just know what styles mesh well. You watch guys, you figure it out. Okay, this guy works well, that guy works well. These two would put on a hell of a fight. All right, boom. And this is what this card kind of reminded of, is that you just found people that you knew their styles were just going to mesh well, and it just kind of, you know, produced a solid up and down card altogether, because everybody just, you know, their styles worked well, and that they're, you know, all action fights and not people that's going to sit back and try to box whatever, and that, you know, they produce really, you know, solid entertainment.
Well, and it's something that I've criticized too in both the recent past and way back when, and even about Premier Boxing Champions, who put on this card, that something that we've even said on shows before, that what I do not appreciate about them, they don't do this all the time or with every card, but often with fight cards that I would consider, or even just in other eras, would be considered just one contender in a very thick, deep division against another, because there is no one single champion at welterweight. And then you have these two welterweights fighting. That's not a blockbuster pay-per-view event, affair, Super Bowl, it's extravaganza, palooza, fucking Woodstock. That shit's a contender versus a contender fight. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's something that I've criticized in the past too. And to be totally fair, I thought that they went against that entirely for this card, which some people might say, so what? So, because I don't know any of those fighters, and who gives a shit? You know, I didn't recognize any of those fighters, and I don't think any of those fighters are going to be superstars, so who cares? Well, I mean, that's not what boxing's all about. You know, boxing's not just about superstars, and I think that that's another portion of what kind of Corey was saying, and what I would also say is that so much of what boxing actually is like not these blockbuster superstar fights, but just dudes doing their job and women doing their job. Just fighting, you know, that's just what they're doing, and they're not getting paid a whole lot of money to do it. So, I mean, it's nice to see just good matchmaking and solid fights.
It is. To go off of that point, like, think about when you mention these big blockbuster pay-per-view shows, right? How many times where the best fight on the card was an undercard fight, not so much the main event? Like, most of the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you an example for, like you said, just really good matchmaking. You remember on, I don't know what undercard it was. I think it was a Lennox Lewis card when Paul Engle fought Junior Jones.
Yeah.
For the, was it for the junior lightweight strap or something like that? And that was a hell of a fight. Like, Jones was, you know, way past it, but he still had enough that he could, like, you know, make out a gritty fight. And Engle was one of those guys who was a really gritty, tough as nails guys too, that, you know, gave high men hell before he got stopped. Like, really badass guy. And those two went to hell and back. I remember Jones dropped him, came back, they won back, and Engle, you know, finally stopped him there at the end. But that was a rousing fight, and that stole the show. You know, I think whoever Lennox fought in the main event, I'm going to say it was Michael Grant, because I think it was from that card. You know, Grant, you know, splattered in two rounds, but an undercard like that, that's the one. It's just good matchmaking.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it's true. And I mean, like
that, yeah.
And I think that some of the funnest cards too have been some of the best and, like, deepest cards, or some of the cards that had the best entertainment value. A lot of them weren't cards where superstar matchups up and down. And on top of that, the funny thing about the whole when people point out like Don King cards from like 1990s, okay, and they'll be like, check this out. You know, Julio Cesar Chavez fought this guy, and then on the same card, Edwin Rosario fought this guy, and then Meldrick Taylor, you know, that type of shit. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But then, like, when you actually look and, like, you know, those fights weren't even that good, dude. Like, the card itself was like, yeah, there were a lot of names on that shit, and it was deep, but it was not, those weren't good fights.
Don King gets a lot of rose-tinted glasses about his pay-per-view shows from the 90s, and I get it. Some of them were, you know, really
some
good,
of them
right?
were.
Some of them, like, he, you know, both Tyson Ruddock cards, he had one of them, I think featured Simon Brown against Maurice Blocker, you know, another card featured Azuma Nelson, Fennec won. Obviously, you got Revenge the Rematches, but those were the exceptions, okay? You forget about a lot of those Mike Tyson undercards that came after he got out of prison. Like, for instance, Tyson Holyfield 2. Which was an absolutely horrendous card, which I think featured Chavez against Larry Lacossiere, Miguel Angel Gonzalez against another no-hoper. So yeah, like stuff like that. You know what I mean? You know, King was always feeding crap on a lot of these shows. And yeah.
Yeah, that's like it's a tried and true tradition to put on like a single really good fight and then like a shite undercard. Dude, this is not.
And this is even trying to, like, to defend, you know, whatever. But, like, it's just funny because, like, everybody shits on Barb Arum on the cards in the 90s, and rightfully so, because most of them featured Butterbean and Mia St. John. And then, you know, a title fight that kind of meant little to nothing, and then the main event of Oscar De La Hoya or whoever it was, right? But then everyone's like, yeah, well, Don King did this and Don King did that. Well, yeah, Don King put on a few good shows, but he also put on a bunch of shitastic shows at the same time, too. It is what it is.
Extremely true. Yeah. It's
yeah. Like really bad ones, you know.
You can't pick out, you know, the handful of good stuff. Some of them were not good. But yeah, there's
especially as the 90s progressed, you know, King just started, he was like, all right, I'm not even trying at this point.
I mean, funnily enough, one of the more fun premier boxing champion cards that I can remember offhand was that card that had, it was Chris Areola versus Curtis Harper, and it was on Spike TV, and it was one of their like earlier premier boxing champions cards, and it was, and I'm pretty sure it was the same card as, like, I want to say it was Josecito Lopez versus shit, I can't remember what else it was, but there was, I just remember it being like a really entertaining card, but it was the one where going into it, everybody was just like, oh, look at this shit, dude. Oh, so I guess they're putting all the shit on Spike, huh? But then, you know, that of course we watched it and we were like, damn, that was some good shit. And, you know, the point just being that it was, you know, it was a lot of fun, much like the Showtime card. And I'd love to see a lot more just of those, another entity that's doing similar kind of stuff that I'd like to see more of is Ring City. Ring City overall, you know, their product, they have a really good thing going with their kind of showbox style of matchmaking. Where
yeah, I'm a fan of Ring City so far. Absolutely.
A lot of, like, younger and a lot of either undefeated or if they're not undefeated, you know, just kind of like a lot at stake type of fights where pitting two younger people against each other and stuff like that, crossroads type of fights, mm-hmm. and matchups that are meaningful and that are going to make fighters want to fight for them. You know, this is exactly the kind of thing that boxing needs, that another element of this, and I'm sorry if I'm dominating this whole thing here, but another element of this is that on these kinds of fight cards, these are the kinds of fight cards that can kind of supply those bigger fight cards or supply the stars or the potential stars for these bigger fight cards where,
yeah
so I don't
shows.
I don't want to see Brandon Figueroa against some totally no hope guy on the undercard of some much bigger show. I would rather see him in this kind of main event where something's at stake. So I liked it. I thought it was good. Don't want to sing its praises too hard forever, but it was a lot of fun.
No, I mean, I top to bottom, I enjoyed it, and it was a good Saturday night for fights. And speaking of, we have another one to look forward to this Saturday.
And that's how you transition, ladies and gentlemen, for sure. Yeah, despite his lunatic ramblings on social media, Josh Taylor, one hell of a fighter.
Oh, and,
sorry. I mean, I can't bring it up, but not talk about
that. No, I said like that because I'm just like agreeing with you. Like, yeah, his lunatic ramblings. Like,
yeah. Fucking yay, man. Holy shit. Just, oh, wow. But as a fighter, incredible fighter, very good fighter. And he's taking on Jose Ramirez on ESPN Plus. Should be a lot of fun.
It's for all the marbles.
It is for all the marbles, or at least for, I guess, what we have deemed the important marbles. Because we're now adding the WBO onto the, if you're going to be undisputed, you now need the WBO. Back when we were, like, 90s, you needed the
WBC. Back WBC. In our day.
Yeah. Back when I was a kid, you needed the IBF, the WBC, and the WBA, and then the you WBA. Were undisputed. And
the Rouge Mikulchevsky didn't really count, people of that ilk back then. You know what I mean? Like, you heard of Chris Eubank, and you heard he was a champion, but you were just kind of like, well, I mean, I guess, but no.
Yeah, that was honestly, they were like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like European style, like kind of fringe, I guess, but like they ain't.
Yeah, the WBO didn't become a real thing, like actually taken seriously until I'm not going to say it. It wasn't like more recently in the past few years. I think it, happened more in the earlier 2000s or more so, but it gradually gained traction from there. Kind of like how I hate to say it, the IBO is however. I mean, they're not even close. Trust me, not like people don't really consider the IBO much, but
some people want to try to make it out.
From where they've been, from where they've been over the past couple of decades, they're probably as far as they've ever been. I'll say that.
Yeah, and look, I guess the old saying is, well, I guess it's not that old a saying because the belts only got split up like that, in like the 1970s is when it really got worsened. But the saying is that the champion makes the belt and not the other way around. And I think that you can kind of say that in some cases that's true. And if we're really trying to sniff out or detective when the WBO or why the WBO became important or recognized, you start looking at Darius Mikulchevsky is probably part of it, but not the reason. In my opinion, the reason would probably be that you started seeing a little bit more wrangling for the WBO heavyweight title in the early 2000s and a little bit more importance placed on it, some pretty good fights.
Yeah.
And I think that's
also like Barrera Morales in the 90s, Hamed even kind of, when he broached over to America.
That too, because, Barrera publicly.
Not Morales, because he wasn't for that, but Barrera was the original WBO champion when he first came on the scene as junior featherweight.
Well, and he like publicly disavowed the WBC too. A lot of people don't remember that Barrera was like, fuck this shit. Like, I don't even need this title. And I mean, I don't know that it was quite like that. He was more just kind of like, nah, I'm good. He, I think, turned it down. He wasn't a dick about it, like I just said. But he did decline it at one point. And I think that probably also helped the WBO gain some recognition that he wasn't turning down the WBO or their rankings and stuff like that. But yeah, it just kind of slowly crept into whatever, dude. Fewer titles, the better. But that's just kind of how it is now. That's just kind of the accepted thing that if you're going to be truly undisputed, then I guess you're going to have the WBO title too. But whatever, I guess we know who's who or who's good. It doesn't necessarily have to have some sort of thing. But that being said, there can be, if you're placing emphasis on belts and titles, there can be no question as to who is going to be the champion on the other side of this fight, assuming there is a clear winner with Josh Taylor and Jose Ramirez. And it is a like I was kind of mentioning a little bit earlier about that Showtime card, an interesting clash of styles where you have one fighter who is a little bit more aggressive than the other, and the guy who's not quite as aggressive can still pack a punch, but is very skilled. I mean, it's a fairly intriguing fight from the standpoint of figuring out who's going to get that upper hand, when, and what the other one's going to do about it.
I mean, it's a fascinating matchup. So many intangibles in the fight, too. Both guys have proven themselves against extremely tough opposition. Both guys are the class of their division, and they're both in their prime right now, both undefeated, and they're fighting for the undisputed championship. It doesn't really get much better than that, you know? And even though the fight seems like it's, you know, a little bit under the radar, you know, real people that are boxing fans and stuff like that are very, very, very hyped about this fight. And rightfully so, because there's no, like you just said, there's no, like, clear-cut favorite in this fight. You know, you could say Taylor, proved himself against Prograce and the way he fights and everything like that, he might have an advantage, but you can't say that, too, because Ramirez is a beast. You know, the way he comes at you, the way he throws, everything about it, like, he's proven himself time and time again when people thought that he might be, you know, the cards might be stacked against him or he might have trouble that night. He risen to the occasion. And he's supremely confident for this fight. So, you know, both guys are. And, I'm just excited for it. The fact that it's not on, like, a fight like this would have been on pay-per-view at one point. But the fact that you can watch it on ESPN makes it even better. So, let's go.
You know, he's got a really – well, Ramirez, that is, specifically, has a very good amateur pedigree.
Yes, they both do.
But specifically Ramirez, he's got a good amateur pedigree, and he's also has experience fighting on, like, the world, on the international level as an amateur. But then, like you said, in a handful of fights going back a handful of years now, there have been a number of times in which he was overlooked, or a lot of people thought that the guy that he was fighting was going to be a little bit too much for him, or whatever the case may be. Mike, yes, indeed, Reed was definitely not too much for him. He took his ass out. Amir Imam, also, you know, Antonio Orozco, just going down the line. Maurice Hooker, a lot of people thought very highly of Hooker, who was undefeated at the time. Victor Postol, you know, was given a number of very good fighters, hard fights. So it's kind of, it's been almost incremental. Jose Ramirez at every single step has been kind of doubted and then proven himself, doubted and proven himself, doubted and proven himself. So I have to give him credit. I don't know that he has progressed enough as a fighter to defeat Josh Taylor, but I have to say that if anybody is going to have the style that I would think would trouble Josh Taylor. I mean, I guess I kind of thought the same about Regis Prograis too, so I could just be totally off the mark on this. But Regis Prograis is a little bit different. And on top of that, I thought that he fell very flat in that performance. I mean, it's not just me like inventing that. A lot of people felt that. Regis Prograis has turned in a better performance since then. But I think that Ramirez has a little bit more aggressive style, placing the emphasis on aggression and the emphasis on, like, body punching and stuff like that, where that could come into trouble Josh Taylor. However, Josh Taylor, very, very good fighter. One of the reasons why I was so excited when DAZN actually kind of broke through and that the news came through that they were doing their thing was because they already had set up the World Boxing Super Series tournaments for super middleweight and for 140 pounds. And Josh Taylor is the guy who won that tournament at 140 pounds. And it's kind of like, all right, well, what does that mean? What is that worth? I mean, I guess I don't really know. And that in and of itself isn't really worth anything, but the tournament itself, I love the tournament format. I love when they take four of or eight or whatever of the world's best fighters in a given division, and they all just go at each other. That shit's great. And that's essentially what happened, and Josh Taylor came out on top, leaving zero doubt that he's the best at 140 pounds. So this is the kind of fight where we get to see whether or not Josh Taylor's rust is an issue, you know, the timeout is an issue, because he's been fairly inactive, as a number of fighters have. But also Ramirez, he's been fairly inactive too, because of COVID, and not that I don't think either of them had COVID, but because there have been so many changes, and it's been a bit more difficult to make fights of this caliber or get fights going, you know, under a lot of these restrictions. But anyway, they've put it together. This fight should be a hell of a fight.
It's going to be guaranteed. If you're going to bet on it for anything, just bet that it's going to be a hell of a fight, because I'm not going to tell you who's going to win. But, it's one of those fights that it just comes with a lot of implications, a lot of emotions. Both people have sizable followings, and they both have incredible resumes, too, when you look at it for the division. I mean, you know, Taylor going all the way back to when he knocked out the extremely tricky Miguel Vasquez. I think he's still the only person to stop him, right?
Long reigning lightweight champion.
Who was just awkward as hell to fight. Yeah,
just a really tricky dude in general. Just his nickname, Titere Puppet, is like perfect, because he just has a very strange movement and style, and he's just fucking impossible to look good against. So, I mean,
he also has a knockout against, you know, in a fight that I remember Boxing Twitter was pretty happy with the result when he knocked out that O'Hara Davies.
Yeah. And I think that I might not 1,000% understand the situation, but I'll try to sum it up the best I can. And if anybody who is from British Boxing Twitter especially, feel free to slap me if I got something wrong. But if I understand correctly, O'Hara Davies signed with, whatever, I guess it was Matchroom, but he had been fairly vocal and a bit of a trash talker throughout his earlier career, and had earned a bit of a reputation for being a trash talker. And then leading into that fight, had a couple of pretty good wins, like, for instance, against Derry Matthews, who I think is since retired. But Derry Matthews had a lot of experience, and that was a pretty big win for Davies. And he talked a bunch of shit after that. And then after Josh Taylor made him take a knee once or twice during the fight, and it was just a big, karma moment, like, where he had talked a bunch of shit and everybody wanted to rub it in his face now. So I think that's basically what it came down to. But he has since somewhat redeemed himself, I think, at least on the regional level. I don't know that he's going to get much past that. Could be wrong.
Yeah, I have no clue. But, you go through and up until, like, even the Prograde fight. That was the big one where Taylor proved himself, because I think a lot of people thought that, Prograde would end up beating him, not knock him out. And he had to go through hell in that fight, too. Like, Prograde's a beast, and really put it on him and landed a lot of combinations. But Taylor, to his credit, was brilliant that night. And he tried to box him at a distance, nothing like that. He stood right in the trenches with Prograde a lot and really just, wore him out. Beautiful display of body punching, and ended up grinding out a convincing decision, a close fight, a very, very close fight, but a fight that he definitely did deserve to win. And yeah, he coming off of a fight like that, and being, looking upon as being maybe the class of the division now, after scoring the biggest win that you can over there up until this fight, he's coming with a big chip on his shoulder.
And they've both been out about roughly the same amount of time, so there shouldn't really be too much of an advantage in terms of rust or, either fighter or the other.
Nope.
And on top of that, in the fight since that Regis Prograde fight that Josh Taylor has been in, he clearly, it's tough to know exactly how much it means because of the guy he was fighting, but he clearly showed that he's motivated to get an early knockout if he wants it. So we're going to see a Josh Taylor, presumably, that's in pretty top form.
Yeah. And same thing for Ramirez. So fire, I can't wait. I don't know, man. I'm not even gonna try to make a prediction right now. Like I go back and forth on it all the time. So
I really don't know. I'd have to say, generally speaking, just overall, when it comes to matchups where there's like a boxer and a puncher or somebody who is a little bit better boxer than the other, I'm usually going to lean toward the person who's the better boxer. It just kind of tends to play out that way usually, I think.
Same.
But I don't know. I mean, I don't really get the feeling that Ramirez is going to pull it off, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, he's proven a lot of people before. He's risen to the occasion. He's definitely going to rise to it right now. For either guy to win, they're going to have to go through hell. And Taylor, I think, might have the better skills in class. But if he can be able to handle the sustained pressure he's going to be able to put on him and the combinations, everything like that, then he might be able to eke out a win. But I think it's going to be a very, very close fight.
It should at least be worth checking out. It should be a lot of fun. One cool thing I do like about ESPN, I've been critical of some of the stuff that they've done, or I mean, mostly it's just about the way that some of their brass talks about their fighters publicly, but more than, whatever they put on, they put it on. If it's a good fight, it's a good fight. And I'm happy to say so. But one of the cool things they do on ESPN is that they air the ESPN Plus cards like on regular ESPN fairly early, and they'll start like with they often air like every fight on the card, which is fantastic. I love that shit. I love flipping that shit on super early and just having early boxing. I love it. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Sure. But one of all day box is never a bad thing.
Crack some beers super early, watch early. I love it. But the main fight of note on the undercard of that Taylor Ramirez fight is Jose Cepeda, who actually lost to Ramirez in 2019, but put up a hell of an effort, and in the meanwhile defeated Jose Pedraza and Ivan Baranchik in October in a bit of a war, a 5-round war. There was
later the year.
Yeah, knockdowns galore. Holy shit. He's taken on Hank Lundy, which is a little bit of a surprise. I mean, I have nothing against Hank Lundy. Don't get me wrong. But I think that it's fairly clear at this point that his best days are almost assuredly behind him.
And it shows you how much you should take seriously a WBC silver title. If
I don't even know what that means,
like, what is he doing fighting for any title right now?
Yeah, I don't even know what the fuck that means, dude. You know what I mean? Like, that's, oh my God, why make it so needlessly complicated, you guys? No, it's, I have nothing against Hank Lundy. And I mean, if we're going to see Hank Lundy, I guess I would rather see him in against somebody who is on this level where it's like they're kind of like a contender, top contender, rather than a young gun going to come up and like take his head off type of shit, where he's just having to take the opportunity for money or something. But yeah, at the very least, we can also be fairly sure that Hank Lundy, he's not going to come in and like lay down. He's going to come in and he's going to give it a good effort, and he usually can go, go rounds.
I mean, Hank is always a veteran. He's been around. He's fought the best of them. He's always had good skills and knows how to handle himself for the ring, too. And not a guy that's always, going to be well intimidated by anybody because he's seen it all. So, yeah, I think, he'll make it interesting for a couple of rounds. But, again, just the fact that it's, for a title is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's a bit much. But like I said, it's like, I was just kind of surprised to see him in the role at all, but I guess not. It's
hell, I worked a fight for his, God, man, back in like, I mean, he's been around way before this too, but I remember I worked one of his fights back in 2014, and he was already looked upon as like a wily veteran back then,
Yeah, dude, I remember watching the Molina fight on, I'm pretty sure that was on ESPN. And I don't even remember what network is on. It doesn't even matter. But I remember watching that, and it was a hell of a lot of fun. He had kind of established himself as a mainstay on ESPN before that, and definitely a fun dude, like an entertaining fighter. Just I just figured it was kind of understood that he wasn't quite on that level. No disrespect, yeah. Again, just it, you know, it everybody kind of has their
no,
role.
No, he always, every time he really, like, he was able to, he did have a good few, you know, he beat a few prospects coming up and stuff like that, but whenever he stepped up to the main level, when, you know, even to, like, main guys that, well, like, the few times they made it to HBO, he fought Delorme, he lost the decision, he ended up fighting Terrence Crawford one time, was it on HBO, right?
No disrespect there either, and there's no shame in losing to Terrence Crawford, but Terrence Crawford did to him, he treated him in a way that clearly demonstrated Hank Lundy is not only not on his level, but he's like at least a notch or two down, you know, like, yeah. Not, yeah, it just is what it is, but no, you know, he should come in and, like I said, give it his all, and I would imagine he's going to go some rounds, but it's probably a good call putting Jose Cepeda in that role or in that kind of co-feature role where,
well, because you know he's going to bring it, he always brings the ruckus.
He is, and assuming he wins, which he probably will, that sets him up to take on the winner of the main event, so, or, you know, potentially anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I guess it's a weight class away, but I don't really know what else they do, what else they have at ESPN, or what other road they're going to go down. But ESPN's doing some funky stuff lately. It's tough to say, or Top Rank, I should say. But yeah. I don't know. We'll see. It should be fun, though.
No, for as long as the fight's going to last, it should be good, because, again, Hank is a guy that's not intimidated. Oro's going to, like, try to back away, and Zepeda's going to come right at him. So, you know, Hank will oblige with that.
Yeah, he'll bring what he's got. I guess, yeah. What he's got is just what's in question. We don't know. But no, it's look, we had a lot of fun fights this past weekend. Oh, and actually, you know what? Before we get out of here, I did want to bring up, I almost forgot, just kind of a quick shout to your old school boy Lou DiBella, because I did catch the fight card he put on this past weekend.
Broadway Boxing, yeah.
I believe, I'm pretty sure it was on UFC Fight Pass.
It was, yep.
And I mean, I couldn't speak to how many people watched or bought it. I didn't really see a whole lot of people talking about it on social media, but I did watch it. And I guess not so much that I want to sing its praises or go on and on about how great it was, although the main event was pretty good. I just thought that it was good to see it's probably like the third or fourth card in the last few months that have been all women's boxing. And I mean, to see it kind of popping up from different promoters is great. And I want to see more of it.
Yeah, man, I'm all for women boxing getting their own platform. And it's a beautiful thing now that that's happening much more frequently. Like you said, that they're getting their own shows, whether it's on UFC Fight Pass or this one or that. But they're getting attention a lot more and a lot more interest is being taken place in it. You know, there's Clarissa Shields is still really big, and she's, you know, her presence on Twitter and whenever she fights, that she garners a lot of attention. And there's a hell of a lot of, you know, whether she has gotten a lot of attention, whether it's good attention, bad attention, whatever you want to call it, she garners attention, right? But she's a really, really good fighter, and probably, you know, maybe one of the best in the world alongside Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano. But the fact that she's moving on to MMA, well, I think will actually bring a lot more interest in women's boxing as well, considering, depending on how successful she'll be. She's obviously not going to be the first woman to cross over into MMA, but she probably is the biggest, most high-profile one at this so far.
Yeah, and well, I think that there are a lot of concerns, too, because I don't know her opponent, but in looking at her record, she is a jiu-jitsu specialist, meaning, you know, I don't know, how many people actually tuning in pay attention to mixed martial arts, but that's, you know, locks, submissions, fighting on the ground. And if that is her opponent's specialty, like, that's exactly what you would not want a boxer going in against. You'd want to put them in.
Not be your first fight, man. Absolutely
not at all. You'd want to put them in against somebody who is striking as their specialty. Yeah. However, that being said, though, is as much as it kind of pains me, because the camp that she's in has some just straight up lunatics. That being said, the camp that she is in, training in mixed martial arts, yeah, there's some funky shit going on. But that being said, there's skill wise, it's one of the best camps in the world to be in to learn how to be a mixed martial artist. And from what I've seen, it looks good. It's just doing something in the gym and applying it in a fight are two different things. I want her to be successful. Nothing to do with that. It's just that I think it's a very big uphill climb, and we'll have to see how she does.
I mean, absolutely. It's definitely it's an entirely different sport, and I don't care how much you train into it and say, okay, I'm ready to throw kicks and all that, unless you have like a background in martial arts yourself that you can like kind of go back to a little bit, so you know you can balance out both sides. It's not something that's an easy transition, just as it wouldn't be for male or female that takes place in MMA trying to jump over to boxing and thinking they're going to be successful in that sport. Like, you'll have middling success here and there, but to say you're going to be outright superstar is like extremely rare. So, you know, I'm curious to watch it. I'm sure a lot of people and a lot of others are too, because you know, the biggest fight that she wants to get made in women's boxing right now is probably her against Savannah Marshall. Would I be right on that?
Yeah, it sure sounds like that's the, like,
one,
you know,
of the bigger fights, like that one. You know, if Katie Taylor and Serrano were able to finally get it on, that'd be huge too. But like, you know, for two ladies in their respective division, both the best in the division, there's obviously a storyline there that Marshall gave her first, then only L, and you know that's the fight. So unless that can be made, I guess, you know, she's gonna try to do what she can in both sports. Because there is, like we said, there's a lot of limited more. There's not as many females in the upper divisions as there are in the lower weight classes. So,
yeah, there's just not the kind of opposition and competition as there are in other weight classes, and that poses a pretty big problem. But yeah, there is that kind of storyline building now that. Basically, Savannah Marshall beat her before, and so no, that's why, you know, that's why Claressa Shields is avoiding her now, and all sorts of stuff. So then, there's also the, like you said, the attention that Claressa Shields brings, both good and bad, or positive and negative, I should say. A lot of it's negative and unneeded and stupid, but that also can sell tickets sometimes and sell pay-per-views or whatever. But you know, it's good just to see that there are more outlets. It's almost like when blogs started hitting in the 2000s and people could all of a sudden publish shit themselves and they didn't have to like wait for books or magazines or journals or anything, but they could just write. And it's almost like similar now to where broadcasting is like do it yourself. Broadcasting is becoming a little bit more easy, a little bit more accessible. You know, in the last couple of weeks, I've watched shows from everywhere, from Massachusetts to Georgia to California to Russia to Bulgaria to whatever that was. Fuck, what was that one? The bare knuckle one from Thailand a couple months ago. I mean,
oh,
know, it's like,
yeah, even with that.
That was some wild shit, bro.
The crane kick.
Mm-hmm. Shit, that was some. I mean, it was great. But point being that, I mean, with a lot of this kind of like do-it-yourself broadcasting popping up and just becoming a little bit more accessible, a little bit easier to do, I think that also means that in a good way that's going to, I mean, I hope, give a lot of women fighters more opportunities to, I mean, even just be seen. And I would hope that, even though I already know that it's not the case, I would really hope that there are more fighters, period, who take those opportunities to. It's like almost like you can't even say you're fighting off TV at this point if you're at a certain level, because it's so easy and cheap to broadcast on like YouTube. that, very, you know, yeah. One of the things that, you know, good old Teddy Atlas says all the time, even like from a trainer perspective, is that when a fighter's young, they don't need to be fighting every single time on TV or three times a year. They need to be fighting like 6, 7, 8 times a year. And if they're not on TV, fuck it. You know, you just need to fight, period, mm-hmm. because you need to get in there. And the kind of the perspective now is that there's so many fighters where, you know, they come out of like the amateurs and like every single one of their pro fights is televised. And if you take that perspective and you're fighting like three times a year, bro, it's going to take you like 12 years to get to 30-0. So, you know, it's getting more accessible. And I think that's a good thing. And I hope that fighters take advantage of that as much as they can. And I hope they're getting paid right.
Yeah. You know, that's all we can ask for right now, because like you said, man, there's more accessible access to boxing than there ever has been. Like, all the stuff that we normally, as a kid, when back in the 90s, I was just reading about in magazines, you know, when Boxing Digest, when they would have, like, you know, their results from all over the country, and they would go, like, state by state telling you what happened. And now, what I would normally would have to read back then, you can just watch whatever. There's always a stream for something, like you said. There's one guy, like Tim Boxeo, who's always posting up streams from all over the world every single day for some kind of shit. And it's crazy. Yeah. And easy to watch, you know. Corey's always talking about different streams that I'm watching. Our buddy from Box Rec Gray over there, he same thing. Like, there's a lot of people that are always, you know, supplying steady boxing on Boxing Twitter that you normally, it's like a whole different world now. And not only that, like, you know, classic footage that fights that and I'm not talking about the fights that still have, you know, never been in existence, like Harry Greb fights and stuff. I'm not mentioning that, but like fights that normally you wouldn't that you normally wouldn't be able to see that took place on CBS or ABC, NBC, whatever, MSG in the 70s, 80s, like classic fights that you always read about, but, you know, it was only like tape traders usually had them and stuff. Now they're always being uploaded on YouTube, and fights that are normally considered rare are now more accessible than ever. It's an awesome time.
It is really cool. It honestly is. You know, there's so much stuff in, is you and I, as like the history types, that we can just like type in it a couple clicks away and just watch some fight from 1940 or some fight from 1993 or whatever the case may be. It's pretty cool.
And they're always being constantly uploaded. And if you ever, you know, have certain fights, you can just tell the person, be like, hey, do you have so-and-so that, you know, you can check into it. And normally the person's usually cool enough that they upload, like, our guy, Iron Bar Boxing. Whenever someone asks a request or whatever, hey, do you have so-and-so as a fighter? He'll put up like 6 fights of them the next day. So.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, man. Some of the stuff that people are putting up. But no, it's like I said, a lot of fun boxing this past weekend. I hope this coming weekend is a lot of fun. And speaking of a lot of fun, dude, it was a lot of fun for me to recap the stuff and do the previews with you, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, this was a blast as always, my friend.
Like I said, opening up, I'm hoping that we're going to do another history thing. We're going to do it. We got the time. We're doing it. It might be a little bit different though than what we usually do, because we came up with a few ideas that I think are really, really cool. And so I think the one that we're probably going to wind up doing should be really fun. And in the meanwhile, if you wouldn't mind and you're on social media, go ahead. And if you're on Twitter, especially, follow Aris Pina at Punch Zone Aris. That's ARIS. And follow me, Patrick Connor, Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there and throw it a like. Whatever app or program, whatever the case may be that you're listening to this podcast through, if you would give us a star rating, like, comment, all of those things help us, and we appreciate it. Aris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Always, man. Have a blast. Thanks, everyone.
All right, later, everybody.